In the matter of the estate of Mary Van Riper versus the Director of the Division of Taxation, may we please have appearances of counsel? Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Curry, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, I'd like to reserve some time.
That's fine.
Thank you. This case raises important points that deals with the question of trust law in the state of New Jersey. The appeal presents a question of law as to the applicability of the assessment of inheritance tax upon the death of a surviving spouse of a husband and wife who had transferred their residence as tenants by entirety to an irrevocable trust in which a disinterested trustee had complete powers over the trust property. The important and operative is that it's an irrevocable trust. The spouse's only interest after the transfer was made was a life estate, which could be terminated upon the complete discretion of the trustee as provided in the trust instrument, which is provided to the court. The first issue as to determine is a deed transferred by tenants by entirety into an irrevocable trust extinguish the tenants by entirety? Yes, it does. Is the trust now the fee simple owner of the real property? Yes, it is. The trust is the fee simple owner of the property and has all of the res of ownership of the property, subject only to the life estates of the two grantors, which were husband and wife. When the deed was signed over by the husband and wife, exactly what was transferred? Well, you look at the transfers by tenants by the entirety, how they are treated by the IRS rulings and the federal law upon which our own inheritance tax scheme is scheduled. I cover this point in Article 3 of our brief, in which I talk about the federal law and the revenue ruling 6577 in 1969, which interprets the United States Code 2036, in which the New Jersey state is modeled, that provides that there's a 50-50 transfer when the tenants by the entirety sever it when both join in the deed. In this case, the court below ignored the Internal Revenue rulings and the case of Glazer versus Holding transfers by husband and wife to children with a retained life estate, holding that the transfer severed tenants by the entirety, and they each only had one-half interest at the time of death in the property. What we have before the court is what happened in this case. They each only had a 50% interest, which they transferred. Tenants by the entirety are joint tenants with the exception that both spouses must sign off. In a joint tenancy, you can't unilaterally change it. One of the spouses can't sign it and break the joint tenancy. Both have to sign off. In order to evaluate what interest Walter and Mary Van Riper had in the instant case, the deed was transferred on December the 5th, 2007. The test is, did Mary have the indications of ownership of time, title, and interest and possession after transfer is made to the trust? By way of illustration, tenants by the entirety are treated under New Jersey law as 50-50 ownership under certain provisions. In a divorce, in a simultaneous death act, you can be married and file separately, and you can disclaim assets transferred to you. Surviving tenant may disclaim under 46.2E.14. What happened here was Walter, and I made a chart, Walter and Mary transferred tenancy by the entirety. They gave away all that bundle of rights that you have as a fee simple owner. What do we have after that? On December the 5th, 2017, we have a deed. The real estate is now owned by the trust. The real estate is the payer of the real estate taxes. It gets a federal tax identification number. It's a separate individual. This trust is so important, as is any other trust, that New Jersey has adopted the Uniform Trust Code because trusts are part and parcel of every estate plan. When that happened, all Walter and Mary had was a life estate in their former home. And what did they transfer? They each transferred what 50% right that they had in the property because really they were joint tenants and both of them had to sign off because they were tenants by the entirety. Walter's life estate ended on December 24, 2007, shortly after he created this. This didn't make any change in Mary's interest in the property. Mary still owned a 50% interest in the property, which she held on to until December 23rd, 2013, and when you're going to evaluate what she transferred. What she actually had was only a life estate. Mary only had a life estate in the property. There's an error in the appellate division, and that's at page 323. It said, Walter's death did not alter the nature of Mary's interest in the property when it was transferred to the trust. She held an undivided ownership interest in the home. Thus, Geiger, this I'll get to that in a minute, has no bearing on the disposition of this appeal. This is incorrect. Mary did not have an undivided interest in the home. All she had was a life estate, which could be terminated by the trustee who was independent.
So, counsel, should when Walter passed, should half of the estate have been subject to inheritance tax at that point?
Yes.
That wasn't done.
That's correct. It was disclosed, but it was not done. If you look at your appendix, under Schedule C,
right,
we show equity in residence at 513 Crescent right. Avenue.
Now, just, if I understand your argument, then when at the estate was transferred into the trust, when Mr. Van Riper, Walter passed, half should have been taxed then, and then when
that's correct.
Passed, not, half should have been taxed.
Not half, not entirely half, because you have to then back out his wife had an interest in the entire property for her life. So you have to figure out what her life estate was worth, and then goes to the remainder man who's a Class D beneficiary.
But no taxes were assessed.
That's correct. I made a mistake as the preparer of the return by showing it, but I showed it to the Inheritance Tax Bureau, that he had a 50% interest, and I reported $525,000.
Is it too late for the state to come back
knocking
on your door?
I believe it is. I believe they're out of time. So they had the opportunity to review this, and I signed off on it. But we disclosed everything. We showed the 50%. And we then showed the copy of the trust, and we indicated they had a life estate.
Well, the division's now arguing that the life estate really changes the calculus here because it was not until Ms. Van Riper's death that the full interest in the property went over through the trust to the niece. That was the critical event.
That's wrong. Because what we have before us is a transfer, which is taxed upon the individual, and this is Mary Van Riper. Mary Van Riper's life estate didn't change when Walter died. He had a 50% interest, he had a lifetime interest in the property.
Let me ask you, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Because of the statement you made earlier, should the estate be taxed more than half now because Mrs. Van Riper obtained more than a half when Mr. Van Riper passed away, so it was worth more?
No, she did not. What happened was...
Isn't that what you said earlier?
No. What I'm saying, when he died earlier, his life estate ended.
Right.
She didn't get anything more. She still had a life estate. That never changed. When we do the tax on Walter, we have to say, what did Walter transfer? He doesn't have any interest anymore.
Right.
But on December the 5th, 2007, he transferred 50%. That's gone now. He can't control it. He can't change the deed.
You said there would be an adjustment for something else earlier.
Yes, there is an adjustment. So when he died, what they look back and say, what did he transfer? He transferred his tenancy by the entirety,
half.
Which really is a joint tenancy. He transferred half.
Are we really, is the tenancy by the entirety, it's been a long time since I was in law school, but it was 100%, it's that obvious. It's 100%. It's 100% interest. Both people have 100% interest in the entire property. That's a theory.
No. 50-50 interest in the property.
No, I know, but the theory of it was that both were tenants in the entirety.
They're intertwined.
As the law, as I understand, has treated it because of the impracticality of taxing an estate, taxing a property twice, or
right.
the inability to divide it for purposes of a divorce.
Right.
It's turning into joint tenants, is it not?
It's considered when you look at the impact when they make transfers as if it were a joint tenant. When you consider what did they transfer. They each transferred their 50% interest in the property. But now that's over.
I understand. You're just stepping away from your case. Is there any legal significance anymore to the theory of tenancy in the entirety? What appears to be, it's being treated just as a joint tenancy would be every time there's a legal proceeding about it.
There is. The legal theory is that both have to join in, that one can't break the joint tenancy.
So that's the only distinction?
Yes. That's the decision.
It's really lost a lot of its historical meaning, has it not?
No, not really, because usually what happens is the surviving spouse gets the entire fee. What happened here is, and what the Inheritance Tax Bureau did is disregard a transfer to this trust saying we're going to disregard it because we want to be able to get back at Walter and tax him.
Okay, so what I'm trying to understand in a very practical way is how Walter's estate should have been taxed at the time of his death. Forget about the fact that you made a mistake. Tell me the way it should have been done.
Sure. When he died, we have to figure out what did he transfer back on December the 5th, 2007.
Okay, so we have the figures. So play it out for me.
Sure. Look at Schedule C, which I gave you. That's Index PA-21. That's $525,000.
Right.
The amicus briefs indicate that there is a provision on the Internal Revenue, under the state.
Forget about code. Just tell us.
I'm just telling you what they
Go
have.
Ahead.
They do a compromise settlement. They figure out what is Mary's life worth based upon life expectancies. And then once they deduct that from the reported $525,000, you'll have a number. And that's what the remainder man's interest in the property is.
So when you say the remainder man, we're talking about the contingent beneficiary?
That's correct.
Okay, so
Class D.
Okay, how do you figure out the contingent beneficiary's tax?
You take the 525, you deduct from it Mary's life estate. What is that worth? How many years does she have left?
Okay, so what is that? Calculate that for us.
I'd have to get an appraisal done by a real estate appraiser to figure out what is the reasonable rental value of this property and how many years does she have in the life expectancy table.
And you're going to determine that at the time of Walter's death?
Absolutely. And I would argue even more, since Mary had dementia and I, as the trustee, had the right to sell the property. The reason why I didn't report it was I thought Mary wasn't going
to
get
it. Okay, I'm trying to understand just how it's done.
Okay.
Forget about.
So you have that number based upon her life expectancy and appraisal of what a life estate is worth. And you take a look at how many years she has. Add that up and you deduct that from 525, and then you have a number that the remainder man.
And when is it paid?
Okay. Then. It would be due then.
Okay. So the money that would go to Mary, a Class A beneficiary, would be free of taxes.
Yes.
The contingent beneficiary's amount, whatever that might be, is going to be taxable at that point?
Yes.
And who's going to pay for it?
The niece, the contingent remainder man.
So this is my question about that. Since this life estate has provisions that allows Mrs. Van Riper to use the entire corpus if she should become ill and not be able to remain in the home, and all that money can therefore be used for her care, upkeep, wherever, and that might be completely used.
Yes.
And there might not be anything left for the contingent beneficiary, correct?
Yes.
And yet the contingent beneficiary will have paid a tax?
We would ask for a compromise tax or ask to amend it if that eventually came. But that's the way the scheme is now.
I want to make sure I understood what you were saying. When the husband dies,
yes,
the niece has the obligation to step in and pay taxes at that time?
Yes.
And she would have paid less in taxes because the house is worth $500 and something at that
yes.
time.
Yes, and also but you'd have to...
Now, she might have paid for something she never received.
That's true. And then she apply for a refund.
But she may not be able to pay. Who knows? She might not be able to pay. What happens if she can't pay the tax?
Then she's going to have to enter into an arrangement. That's what the scheme
this
provides.
Is a really crazy thing that you're paying a tax on inheritance that you're not receiving.
Other states have statutes that particularly govern this, where the surviving spouse can elect to continue.
Is there a statute that provides the answer along the lines of what you're suggesting?
Not New Jersey, other states.
So if the niece does not have the funds at that point, is there a possibility that we would be looking at a forced sale of the property?
She could probably get a mortgage on the property.
Assume she cannot.
Yeah, and if she can't afford it, of course, then we'd have to work on an arrangement with the Bureau.
So we'd have, is there a possibility of a forced sale of the property?
Theoretically, there could be.
How could
So we have a situation where a trust was created and for whatever reason, the monies are not available to pay the 50% tax. The surviving spouse with the life estate is not able to remain in the home.
How do we know
that was what the legislature intended?
I don't think it was what they intended because this is a very unusual situation.
But doesn't it lead, if we do the 50-50 taxation, 50 at the death of the first spouse and then with adjustments and then the other payment later, That's the possibility. Why not opt for the state's suggestion instead?
Well, this case has presented the situation where we now find ourselves in, where the appellate division has ignored a transfer, fee simple transfer to a trust because it's one of those hard cases that we read about in law school. But that's what the law is. There was definitely a transfer out from them. They don't own anything more than life estates. As a practical matter, as the trustee, I would go out and borrow the money and pay whatever taxes they would do.
In response to the Chief Justice's question, I want to make certain I heard this correctly. Were you suggesting that the contingent beneficiary could move for a forced sale of the property in which Mrs. Van Riper is living in?
What I'm saying is the state could ask for that, and I would argue that they can't because Mary has to be subject to a life estate. They can't take away Mary's life
estate. So then there can't be a forced
sale. They could not force it.
Okay.
They could move for it.
Maybe
my mistake. If I meant that, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Okay, so you're saying there could not be a forced sale.
It would be subject to Mary's life estate. We can't force that unless Mary agreed to it or I, as the trustee, agreed to it. I could agree to mortgage it, which is what I would do.
Is there any other circumstance where a beneficiary is paying taxes on an estate before the beneficiary is receiving anything from the estate?
I don't know of any.
Is the model that you're describing consistent with how this situation would be handled under the federal tax scheme?
Oh, the federal tax would consider the first transfer as a gift.
We don't have
a gift tax, though. See, our law doesn't perfectly match
with
the federal law.
What transfer are you saying is a gift?
When they transferred it to the trust, you would have a gift tax under uh, 26 U.S. Code 2036. Transferred would retain life estate. That would be put in their estate.
So you're talking about the benefit that ultimately goes to the contingent beneficiary who was, I believe, Class D.
Yes.
Would be considered a gift tax.
Yes.
So the grantor would pay the gift tax because gift tax is paid by
the
grantor.
Right. Yes.
So why Walter would have paid. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm just trying to understand why we, state law would be deviating so dramatically.
We haven't adopted a gift tax.
I know.
The big problem I have here is that we're ignoring a transfer to a trust and the implications for other cases. A tenancy by the entirety has to be terminated when two of the joint tenants, or the tenants by the entirety, sign a deed. And that's what my concern is. If this law stays on the books, that's what the law says. And that certainly is not the law throughout the country. That's why we've adopted the trust code.
Do you agree with the State Bar's position that the interpretation given by the director in the appellate division has the result of taxing this race essentially 200%?
Yes. Because Mary only had 50% to give. When she went to made the transfer, she only had 50% to give.
You've practiced in this area. Is that what's happening?
That's what they're asking for.
Are you familiar with cases where there's been the 200% taxation?
No, I am not. I don't mean to represent that.
So that's not really a practical concern here.
That technically could happen. Here's my point.
Why would it be 200%? They're only seeking half.
No, they're not. They want 100%.
Well, they want 100%, but how?
They want 100% once at the passing of the second spouse.
But so not twice.
Excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead. How do you get to 200%?
Basically, Marion only had 50%.
There would only be 200% if they had taxed Walter at 100% when he died, and then they taxed her 100%.
Yes.
But the proverbial Walter ship has sailed.
It
can't happen. So you're not looking at a 200%
tax correct.
Now.
That's correct.
That would have a pretty good argument if they came forward and asked for 200%. But
of course I did. Of course, no, that's true.
And it didn't happen in this case.
It did not. But the problem I have with this is that I disclosed all this, and they signed off. I disclosed the life estate. I gave them the return, and they signed off on it. And now they're trying to make up for it. And the problem is, to do that, they're asking the court to ignore a basic law, and that's a transfer to irrevocable trust. And that's why you see amicus briefs here, because the law, the impact would be terrible.
But let me just understand something. You acknowledge that when you filed the tax return for the estate of Walter Van Riper, that 50% should have been taxed at that time.
Less the
value of the life
estate. Yes.
And now, later, Mary dies, and then 50% would be taxed at that time.
Yes.
That's the way it should have happened.
Yes.
Okay. So in because of a potential for 100-100 in a different situation, you're telling us adopt the federal scheme, except that we don't have the gift tax component of the federal scheme, so it makes no sense to adopt that. Plus, there's no legislative intent whatsoever to do that.
I'm just saying to adopt the New Jersey scheme.
Well, what is the New Jersey scheme?
To tax the person who died, who was before you, was Mary Van Riper, and she's the transfer here.
And you say tax her 50%.
Yes.
And they missed the boat on Walter.
We both did. Yes.
Everybody missed the boat on Walter.
Yes, true.
So that ship has sailed.
And they're
the right thing to do is divide it 50-50.
Yes.
So you are agreeing with the state bar.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so you are in sync with what the state
Absolutely.
Bar wants to
and
say.
Our concern is that this is a case that's going to set a terrible precedent with regard to transfers by tenants by the entirety to trust.
You essentially don't want a ruling that ignores the fact that a legal transfer took place with the creation of the irrevocable trust.
Absolutely.
That's the most important part for
Absolutely.
You. Okay.
Is there anything else?
Yeah, I have one question. Just take your time, because I'm a little slower than the rest of us up here. Right?
It's all my judge.
Take your time. You keep saying 50% of the value of the property at $525,000. If we recognize the transfer to the irrevocable trust, once that transfer is made, all Walter has is a 50% life estate, correct?
No, a life estate means that the entire estate for his life. You can't have 50% life estate.
Okay, he has the entire
right.
life estate.
Yes.
Life estate for the whole property for his life.
Yes.
Why is that? Since it's only a life estate, why is that 50% of the value of the property?
It's not. It's a transfer within 3 years of death. That's why I had
so
to report
you're,
it.
Okay. So you're now once Mary is involved.
Because she had retained a life, she had retained an asset that's going to be on death.
And that is only a
yes.
50% interest in the life estate value of the property?
No, 50% of the fee of the property, because that's when that's all she transferred out was 50%. But because she retained a life estate, then they call it back in. And she had the life estate when she died.
I got you. That was
I could have transferred, as a trustee, I could have broken that by selling it, because I thought she was going to have to go to a nursing home, but did not.
You understand, of course, we're looking for a principle that will apply going forward.
I, of course, do.
That would apply to the most harmonious of families and ones that don't get along all that well. So what if the niece isn't really all that interested in what happens to uncle and aunt, whichever one survives, and says, I've got this pot of money coming to me. I'm not looking to pay $70,000 today in hopes that X years from now I might get that money back. I want to sell that property. What's to stop that from happening?
Because they have a life estate. Mary would have to consent to that.
And what's your authority for that?
She has a life estate. She can't break the life estate. The original
the life estate, while that property
exists.
Remains in the trust.
Yes.
What's to stop the trust from selling it?
Nothing.
At Mary's direction?
No, not at Mary's direction, at the trustee's direction. And I would not sell it for that purpose if I were the trustee.
But some trustees just might.
Trustee Mayor.
Well, you have a fiduciary duty to your life standard.
There is a trust instrument
yes.
that gives directions to the trustee.
Yes.
And the trustee has to abide by those.
Yes.
It's my understanding. The trust instrument here gave Mary the right to live in that house unless she was unfit to do so.
Yes.
In which case, then she would go somewhere else and the corpus would be used to support her, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And the trustee could not break with the terms of that trust.
Absolutely.
When she went somewhere else, at that point, the life state ends. If she has to go to a nursing home, can the niece then sell it?
No, because first of all, it would be consumed, so you then have the assets in cash.
Well, it wouldn't be consumed until payments were made to the nursing home periodically.
Well, you'd have to sell the house because it was just a residence, so you'd have to sell it to get
liquidity. That's a house. Where would that money go?
That would be put in another trust,
well,
subject to
well, you're assuming there's no trust. I mean, your hypothetical steps would be put in another trust. Let's say that she had to go to the nursing home. So that breaks the life estate because it was as long as she could live at the house.
Yes.
Now it goes to the niece, and she decides, I'm going to sell it, and I'm not going to waste money on mom's or...
She couldn't do that because, first of all, the money would go into... There was also another trust established, the family trust. It would go into that trust, and that's for Mary's care and maintenance for a lifetime. I would have to follow the directions as trustee to take care of her. I was supposed to provide for a living, and it specifically said if she had to go into a nursing facility, I had to take care of her. I would use the funds for that. So in all likelihood, they would be all eaten up by the time.
But you're telling us the niece has the personal obligation, as this transaction is structured, to pay the taxes.
On the first death, yes.
And if she chooses not to?
There would be an assessment on the property.
And what if that trust were house poor?
What, sir?
That the essence of the trust, the assets that the trust held, assume the property had been deeded over to the trust 15 years before and the property increased in value, and that was essentially the trust. There were no other assets in there to make the payment on the tax. You're going to mortgage the property in your discretion.
If I could, yes.
And she could be on the hook if it's... for some reason loses value.
Well,
So it's not such great news if somebody calls you and says, guess what, you're the beneficiary of a trust or aunt and uncle.
Well, it depends on the trust.
So I'm trying to understand something based on your answers. If the contingent beneficiary doesn't pay the tax, let's say it's $70,000, just making that up, then you're saying the taxing authorities can place a lien on the property.
Yes.
Okay, so let's play this through. Mary can no longer live in the house.
She could.
Let's say she can't. She's ill, okay? Now she has to go to a nursing home.
Yes.
You have to sell the property, okay? And the corpus of that property is now to support Mary. And you're going to take $70,000 off of that from the contingent beneficiary? And Mary's going to lose $70,000 towards her support?
I wouldn't pay the taxes then.
How would you not? There's a lien. You said there was a lien on the property.
If I needed to sell the property, yes, I would have to pay those taxes, yes.
I know you're not advancing this proposition, but is this scenario and those like it avoided if the tax is paid at the end after the second spouse passes?
Yes, if there was such a statute.
Statute doesn't answer the question either way, though.
I know.
I thought you told us that.
No, I meant Pennsylvania does. Not New Jersey. Okay. It's in one of the other briefs, Judge.
Understood. Other questions, anyone? No. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. DeMail.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Thank you for allowing the New Jersey State Bar Association to participate as a friend of the court in this very important case. Our goal is not a financial one. Our goal is to promote certainty and predictability of the law, and in this case, it's the inheritance tax law. We believe that the decisions below create uncertainty and create potential confusion because they make radical changes to some of the basic principles of New Jersey inheritance tax. And because those are basic principles, they have the potential not only to affect the type of trust that Mr. and Mrs. Van Riper created, but they have the potential to affect many other estate planning techniques that very common estate planning techniques that our clients use day in and day out. So let me focus first.
I'm sorry, could it affect the normal marital trust that happens when one spouse dies before the other and taxes are deferred until the second spouse's death?
A bypass trust or a credit shelter trust impacted by the implications of these rulings. And that gets to the first point that I want to make is that the inheritance tax is a tax on transfers. It's not a tax on holding possession of something at death. There's two requirements, that there be a transfer, and in the case of a property that's transferred by will at the time of death, that's easy. But when there's a transfer during lifetime, you have to have something else, either a death within 3 years or a retained interest like we have in this case. So it's transfer plus something. It's not just something else.
Could you flesh out your answer to Justice Patterson's question? How would a bypass or a credit shelter trust be affected?
In a bypass or credit shelter trust, the surviving spouse is a beneficiary only. The surviving spouse never transferred anything to that trust because the trust was created by the first spouse to die. And so the surviving spouse has an interest, has the right to use those trust assets. You typically has the right to income, typically has the right to compel that principal be used for the surviving spouse on whatever standard that the trust states. But the surviving spouse never made a transfer. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Mary Van Riper has a half interest.
So how would a ruling in this case affect that?
Because that the ruling in this case says Mary Van Riper's estate is subject to tax not only on what she did transfer, namely her half interest in the house, but her estate is also subject to tax on something that she did not transfer, something that her husband put into the trust, namely his 50% interest in the house.
When the husband passed, that half went to Mary. So she actually transferred the full amount instead of niece, because she now held, once the husband passed, she inherited that half of the estate, so she had the entire estate. So she's actually not passing her half, she's passing the entire res.
She had, after Walter passed, having made this transfer of his half interest in the trust, and after he passed away, the trust continued, and Mary had a right as beneficiary to share in the trust and to use the house. And if the house had to be sold, she was a beneficiary. There were to be
the money. She had the full proceeds, did she not?
I'm sorry?
If the house was sold, the entire proceeds of the sale would have gone to Mary.
If the house was sold...
Absent taxes, but...
The proceeds would stay in the trust, and they would continue to be used for Mary's benefit, because she could now be in an earthly
home. So she had 100% of the res.
But that's where the court's below...
When she transferred to the niece, right?
Yeah. That's where I believe the courts below went wrong. They're confusing the right to use all of the trust assets
with ownership.
The transfer plus retain the right to use.
She couldn't sell the house and just take the proceeds and go live somewhere else. It had to be used in accordance with the trust document for her benefit in a nursing home or something along those lines.
Yes, and her right to use the and get the benefit of the whole thing is a right as a beneficiary of the trust.
It was not a right as a result of his death, because his transfer all took place at the time the trust was created, correct?
Well, for inheritance tax purposes, the real taxable event, first taxable event, took place on Walter's death. Walter made a transfer.
But at his death, his death did not transfer anything with regard to the house to her, did it? Because the trust owned the house. Am I not understanding your position correctly?
No, when he transferred his half interest to the trust, a bunch of rights arose. He had retained the right to use the house and the proceeds. He gave to his wife, because she, under the trust agreement, had the right to use the house and the proceeds. So they were both life tenants, but in conjunction with each other. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, there was a transfer that created very important rights when Walter and Mary created the trust. The first taxable event, though, took place when Walter passed away. Mm-hmm. Now the inheritance tax kicks in because he has made a transfer, half interest in the house, and he has retained the right to use everything that was put into the trust. And so his 50% should have been taxed at that point.
I don't understand that. His death, when the house has already been transferred to the trust, causes a transfer in ownership interest to the wife as if he was somehow still the owner of that property, residual from his prior tenancy by the entirety?
Let me use this as an entree to address that whole question of what should have happened on Walter's death. When Walter died, he had made this transfer, and the statute 34-1C was triggered because he had made a transfer and retained this ownership, this interest, this beneficial interest in the trust. By the way, when the house was transferred to the trust, the tenancy by the entirety was completely severed.
Right.
You can't, in New Jersey, have a trust property owned as tenancy by the entirety. A trust owns, the trustee has title, but not as tenancy by the entirety, even
so
if the beneficiaries happen to be husband and wife.
That tenancy by the entirety, it disappears on the date the trust is created. 3 weeks later, he dies. And at that point, it seems to me, maybe this is following up on Justice Lebecki's
point,
that the only event happening is that he no longer has a life estate in that property, as of the death.
Right.
That's the event that happens.
That's the event.
From a,
so is it taxable because it was within 3 years of death?
It's taxable because Walter made a transfer and retained the right to use that property for the rest of his lifetime.
So
it
why would
you
just
a tax? Few days.
Why would you just tax the actuarial value of that life estate?
We do, actually, because when you calculate that tax that occurs on Walter's death, you have to look where does the property go, because our inheritance tax is a tax on assets passing to Class C and Class D beneficiaries, and Mary was a Class A beneficiary, and Mary was the primary beneficiary of this trust.
Right, so she's she at that point is the key beneficiary. It's not going to go to the niece at that point. So the only tax would be on the actuarial value of his life estate?
No, because when he dies and the tax is triggered, we have to look at what are the actuarial possibilities as to where this property is going to go. We know that it has to be held in trust for Mary's lifetime, but we also know that Mary is 80 or 90-something years old, and there's a niece who probably will get the property down the road. Now, she may not get anything, as somebody mentioned, because this money could be used for Mary's care. But she had, at that point, as of Walter's death, the niece had a remainder interest, which was enforceable.
So you calculate the value of what went to Mary, right, her life estate based on how long she's expected to live and the value of the property, and you also calculate the value of what is likely to go to the niece. And you tax both of those things?
No. Remember that Mary is exempt from
tax.
She's
exempt. Okay.
And so Mary had the life estate, and that's easy to calculate, a life estate. We have actuarial tables, which the division publishes. They assume a 6% discount rate, and that's easy to calculate the value of a life estate.
What you're really calculating is the taking into account probabilities, for lack of a more technical word, of how likely it is that the property will go to the niece and what it'll be worth when it goes.
And that's where the compromise tax comes in and the compromise procedures.
Do you agree with Mr. Curry's analysis? Do you differ with it at all?
Well, I differ in one respect. I think Mr. Curry said that tax could be imposed on the niece at that point, Walter's death. I don't agree with that. That tax is a tax on Walter's estate. After all, Walter is the one who made the transfer and retained the life estate. And so there's an inheritance tax imposed on Walter's estate. Walter's executor or administrator, who's ever in charge of his estate, is personally liable for that tax, but it's a tax of the estate and typically is paid from the estate assets. I have not seen in all my years a situation where a remainder beneficiary who is not to receive something until some point in the future actually was called on
so
to
you're,
pay.
So what you're saying
tax.
Is the life estate, money in the trust, has to pay the tax for the contingent beneficiary, and that therefore takes away money that could have been used to support Mary?
Well, Walter's estate may have other
correct?
Assets, and so it could come from other assets. But if there are no other assets, I guess it depends on the tax allocation rules. Remember that the will can say, if there's tax on my estate, here's what share it gets paid from my assets, from my trust that I created, and the trust could have provisions on contributing to tax.
I want to bring you back just for a moment to your opening remarks. Certainty and predictability. I don't know why what you're proposing is more certain and predictable than what the state is proposing from what I'm hearing.
Well, let me say this. The uncertainties that you're concerned about on that first spouse's
yes.
death are a direct...
And I don't see agreement between you people either.
There are a direct and inevitable result of the way the statutes are structured. The statutes, we're looking at 34-1C, but 5436-3 and the statutes in that chapter deal with the compromise procedures. They call it a...
Let me ask you, as you bring up statutes, in other states, is this all spelled out in statutes and regulations?
Well, there aren't that many states that have an inheritance tax anymore, but the one state that we have referred to is Pennsylvania.
Okay, and they spell it all out.
And they have a procedure to deal exactly with this situation.
And that's by statute.
And their statute says, if you have a trust that primarily benefits a surviving spouse and other people are going to benefit, then the surviving spouse or the estate has the option to defer the tax until the surviving spouse's death.
So my question is, should the State Bar or lawyers who practice in this field or the division or somebody be going to the legislature and saying we have a gap in our law? Because it seems to me, tell me if I'm wrong, that we have a situation where the law, our statutes and regulations do not directly address a real-world situation that has come up in this case. Am I right about that?
I respectfully disagree. I think our statutes...
I'm happy to hear that.
Statutes and regulations do address this situation.
Okay.
They do it through the compromise tax procedure, and they say that that tax, if it's not compromised, is going to be paid when the niece, when the remainder beneficiary, takes possession. But they say... recognizing
that
estates don't want to leave that issue open.
Isn't that the situation here? They're trying to seek it now? The state?
I don't know.
Basically, your argument, as I understand it, wrapped in a nice package, is the state had the opportunity to collect the money at the death. They didn't, and it's too bad. They lose now because they didn't do it timely. Isn't that really your argument?
Again,
we cut out all the other stuff.
Not about the financial, who pays tax and when. Our arguments are to try to preserve the coherence and the predictability of our statutes, which do provide for this compromise tax procedure.
So the way that would work out, and you're telling us that this is rooted in our statutes and regulations, is when Walter dies, you do a calculation of the value of the life estate that he lost by virtue of his death just 3 weeks after this trust was formed, and that should have been taxed at that time.
The actuarial value of the remainder interest to Ms. Kresge should have been taxed
In her remainder interest based on the contingencies. Then, okay, nothing happens during the lifetime of Mary, right? Nobody's taxed until she dies. Then she dies, and her remainder value is then taxed?
What's taxed at that point is her transfer plus retained interest. And remember, she transferred her equal ownership interest, 50%, and retained the right to use that property. So what should be taxed on her death is 50% of the value of the house.
Even though the transfer she made was before her husband's death, you wait until she dies because she has a life estate, and then you tax the value of the transfer that she made several years before.
That is correct.
Okay.
That's the way the statute works.
And then is the state made whole, as it were, in terms of it has taxed somebody for the entire value of the house?
That's correct. Now, it doesn't always end up to be 100% because, remember, on that first death, there are uncertainties as to how long people
are going to
live, whether things are going to be distributed. But at least you have taxed one half based on the rules in effect and the probabilities in effect at the time of Walter's death. And you tax the other half, in effect, based on what we know at Mary's death, namely everything at that point is going to the niece.
So go easy on us. You've said that's what the statute says. Tell us where.
Oh, the statute on the retained interest is 5434-1C, and that says that when you make a transfer, and the word transfer is in that statute multiple times, and you also retain the right to use that property, that's what triggers an inheritance tax under that statute.
I understand that, but 54:34-1C doesn't appear to give us an answer as to whether your proposal as opposed to the division's proposal is correct. Does it?
I believe it does, and I can tell you that that's the way it's been interpreted and administered by the bar over years and years. And the whole issue didn't come up until this relatively unique situation came up where Walter, they both created the trust and Walter died. And I believe that the fact that the tax was not collected on the first spouse's death is a critical element here. Because
who's
I think we can
for
all...
That?
I'm sorry?
Who? When the division of taxation does not tax an estate based upon a filing that is not complete, who bears the short end of the stick there? The state or the party that has filed the estate tax?
I'm not sure I can answer that question definitively, Your Honor, that there would be statute of limitation questions involved. And I am not prepared to answer that. But there are rules, and the state may or may not be barred, but at oral argument before the appellate division, I think the director's counsel conceded that they were barred from imposing tax at this point on Walter's estate.
Okay. But you're saying that that should have happened, that it would have respected the principles under which lawyers create trusts in this kind of situation where there's a Class D beneficiary in the end, and that would have essentially made the state whole to more or less.
That's
in
correct.
Terms of its right to collect inheritance tax.
Whenever we administer an estate where there's a trust taking on that trust, that estate's property, we know that you're going to have to look at the inheritance tax consequences. You're going to have to look at whether you need to file a return, whether you need to propose a compromise tax or let the state propose a compromise tax. This is all procedures that we are used to. So if the concern is we're creating some quagmire, it's not a new quagmire. It's a quagmire that we are familiar with dealing with.
I hear you, that you have settled practice and you're saying don't unsettle what we understand to be the rules right now. Can you tell us why one or the other proposal offers greater predictability if the rules were made clear by an opinion of this court?
Well, I think if the rules were made clear by a court decision, I just question whether that can be done in the modicum of a court opinion in a way that a statute can do it. The legislature enacts statutes, the division proposes and enacts regulations subject to public comment, and I just think that what I'm describing as the procedure is the statutory procedure, and if you like another procedure that's a little bit different, it would be up to the legislature.
Let me ask it differently. Suppose the court accepted the argument of the division. Why would the result create problems of predictability and certainty?
Well, I think there would be questions about the extent to which that applies in other situations. After all, we are dealing with the estate of Mary Van Riper, and it's a trust created from tenancy by the entirety property, benefits husband and wife both with the provisions that are in this particular trust agreement.
You said earlier
this is a unique situation. I have difficulty with that concept. This is an elderly couple who had a property. They put it into a trust for tax purposes and bequeathed it to the niece after the death of both. I don't see how that can be unique. That must happen 100
Well,
times
I think
a week.
This property was, this trust was created probably for Medicaid planning purposes more than anything else. Remember that it didn't really...
I'm sure that
really
happens every day, too.
Correct. And so, yes, this is going to happen, but I can't tell you if the court upholds the decisions below and tries to give some guidance as to what this whole new procedure entails, that's going to provide any more predictability through the method of a court opinion.
It might, but it's going to increase the taxation on the estate. I mean, one of the reasons why I see the proposals on your side is because it's going to lessen the amount of taxation on the estate, correct?
I'm not sure that it would. It's going to depend on the particular case and the actuarial.
Take this case. If we accept your proposal and your colleague's proposal, there will be less tax on the estate, no?
Would there be less tax overall? Probably, because The one transfer took place at a time when a big interest in the property was passing.
Because the niece is going to be taxed as a Class D beneficiary on the entire corpus of the life estate. That obviously will lead to greater tax than what you're proposing, no?
And I a little bit bristle at the idea of a proposal, because we do really believe this is the existing
law. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm just asking a question. That doesn't mean that what you're saying is wrong. I'm just asking you a fact.
The tax may well be higher if you defer
tax. It's a difference between 100% and 50%, isn't it?
But statutes don't provide for that. Pennsylvania statutes
do. But you're saying that if Walter's estate had been taxed properly, it really wouldn't have ended up being very different. In other words, if that original event had been taxed, the transfer had been taxed at the time of his death, then what you're saying is the current and established practice would not have really shorted the state very much at all, because between the first and second taxable events, it would have ended up pretty much the same with what they're looking for here.
It may have produced less tax because there was the intervening spouse's estate, beneficial interest rather, which would have been tax-free.
And it would have been on one half. Of course it would have been less. I mean,
well, you would have had the one half going through the system on his death and the other half going through the system.
And one half taxed as a contingent beneficiary as opposed to a Class D beneficiary on the entire corpus. I mean, it's clear that under your proposal the tax is less. No?
The tax would be less because of the intervening interest of the surviving spouse.
So what is it that you think the appellate division got wrong in their opinion?
I think they ignored the transfer requirement, and they paid more attention to the fact that Mary Van Riper had the right to use the trust property. That she certainly did have the right to use the entire trust property, but she did not transfer the entire trust property. And so the appellate division almost treated this as if it were a tax on couples. The New Jersey inheritance tax is not a tax on couples. It's a tax on individual estates. And so when Walter died, there was a taxable event. What the appellate division did is pretty much lump everything together and say, well, let's just treat it, Mary and Walter, as a single unit and tax everything on the second spouse's death. That's what Pennsylvania law permits as an option, but that's not what the New Jersey statutes provide for.
If the property had not been moved into the trust while both were alive and they simply had their will and Walter had died, Mary would have taken simply by the result of being a tenant by the entirety, right?
That's correct.
And if they had wills that then both named the nephew or niece as their beneficiary, and the money after her death had flowed from the property to the beneficiary, we would end up in similar situation to where we are now. Is that correct?
Well, we would be in a similar situation to where the state says we are now, namely no tax on Walter's death,
right,
but an entire tax on Mary's death.
Right.
But that's not what they did.
No, because your point is that the trust changed the flow of the movement, of the transfer of property.
And the trust, yes, Your Honor, and the trust created some very important legal rights and relationships which the tax, inheritance tax law recognizes.
Anything else you'd like to add? I think we're just
yes,
at 5 minute mark.
Okay, just answer one question, Justice Patton. I'm very sorry. The significance of tenancy by the entirety. There may be not much difference for inheritance tax purposes between tenancy by the entirety and tenancy in common, but there are other very important legal distinctions regardless of the way this case turns out. For example, creditor protection. There are many creditor protection aspects of a tenancy by the entirety which don't apply to a joint tenancy or a tenancy in common. The recent case of Jimenez versus Jimenez is an example. So creditor protection is just one example. And so whatever decision is made here, it will not...
It's not going to throw that concept out.
Correct. Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Eastman.
May it please the Court, Edward Eastman appearing for the New Jersey Land Title Association. The New Jersey Land Title Association is a title insurance underwriting company's business in the state of New Jersey. They have more than 90% of the title insurance underwriting companies as their members. What they're seeking by participating in this matter is predictable with accuracy escrows that are being held by the title insurance industry when property is being sold pursuant to a trust. We need the ability to calculate the amount due, the amount to be held in escrow. And in this case, as it began to work its way through the court system, it seems as though we couldn't actually predict in cases such as this with certainty without the court's help.
Are you in line with the State Bar's proposal as to how these various transfers or events should be taxed?
Yes, I believe that it leads to stability.
And who has the obligation to pay the tax on the passing of the first spouse?
Well, I think that under the statute that it can be postponed until the second to die. That would be NJSA 54:36-3. Even though it's assessed, it's not levied until the person comes into the beneficial enjoyment of the estate.
So it's assessed at the time of the first spouse's death, in this case Walter's death, but not levied on until the second spouse's death?
Yes.
And that's been in the statute?
54:36-3.
And what if there's nothing left in the estate? So at the time of Walter's death, the contingent beneficiary's tax assessment is X, but by the time that Mary dies, there's very little left in the estate. What happens to that assessment?
Well, that's why mention was made that careful practitioners would go into a negotiation with respect to settling the estate. This was called the compounding statute. Because it could be that the remainder gets the entire estate because the person with the life estate dies early, or it could be they get nothing. And they work with the tax bureau in order to set the amount as a compromise.
And that's the compromise proceeding that the State Bar's Council was talking about?
Yes.
So you and your fellow amicus understandably want a clear rule going forward for purposes of predictability. Why is the proposal that you've laid out one that offers greater predictability than the state's?
Well, when I looked at the statute regarding, when I looked at the case law regarding tenants by the entirety, it became clear that there were four unities of interest that needed to be created to maintain a joint tenancy by the entireties. That's title, time, possession, and interest. And in this case, once the Van Ripers irrevocably transferred their property to the trust, their tenancy by the entirety was terminated because they no longer had unity of time or title. That was one of the reasons why the very basis for the state's position that it was taking was that the Van Ripers estate was subject to a tenancy by the entirety when it was not.
You're saying the state's position is premised on the principle that there's still a live tenancy by the entirety, but there hasn't been one since the trust was created?
Yes, that's what their position is. But from the moment that the trust was created, the deed was taken out of the Van Ripers into the trust. The tenancy by the entirety was extinguished, and the only thing that they had left was a life estate in each of them.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This is an unusual case, not unique per se, but certainly unusual. But it can be very straightforward. And the basis is, what is the inheritance tax? The inheritance tax is, in fact, a tax on transfers of property. The question that we have in this case is not if the property should be taxed, but when the property should be taxed. The statutes of this state say that if a decedent transfers property but maintains a right in that property, for example, a life estate, then it's taxable upon their death. 100% is includable and taxable upon their death. It's 54:34-1. So the concept is, if that decedent holds a string onto that property, if they keep a little bit of ownership and control over that property, then it's includable in their estate, even if it's been transferred 10 years before. And that's what we have here. In this case, Mary and Walter owned property as tenants by the entirety. They placed it into a trust that clearly stated that 100% of the trust was for the benefit of, essentially, Mary. That the property had to be used for Mary's care. If it was sold, the proceeds of the property had to be used for Mary's care. And if the house was sold, then Mary needed to be either bought another house for her to live in, or the proceeds to be used for her to have some type of facility care. The niece, the Class D beneficiary, did not obtain any rights to this property until Mary died. She did not obtain interest in this property when Walter died. She couldn't have forced a sale. She couldn't have mortgaged the property. She couldn't do anything with that property. She couldn't kick Mary out. She didn't obtain the property or rights to the property until Mary died. And that's why 100% of the value of the property is includable in Mary's estate, because that's the last string. That's the last thing that prevented the niece from obtaining 100% full ownership rights of that property. Because until Mary died, the niece had nothing. She had a hope that she might get something. Because, in fact, if Mary's care, if Mary went into a nursing home and her care cost more than the value of the property, there'd be nothing left.
You heard Mr. DeMeo's presentation. He said, this is the way it's been done, the procedure that he laid out, 50% with an adjustment at the passing of spouse one, and then again at the passing of spouse two. Do you disagree?
I do disagree, Your Honor. And I disagree because there's a distinction between
and
the
again,
fact...
My question is, do you disagree that that's the practice that has been going on in the state?
Yes, Your Honor, I do disagree.
Please go ahead and explain.
I disagree because the facts of this case are not the most common trust method used in this state. The cases that come, the estates that are filed with the Division of Taxation, what we see are decedent, the spouses transferring the property to themselves as tenants in common, and then transferring the property into separate trusts. So the fact that the property was owned as tenants by the entirety and went directly into a single trust with trust language that was as crystal clear as this trust language was is not the most common estate planning method that we see in this state. Now, in a circumstance where, in fact, they were owned as tenants in common and transferred into separate trusts, then the compromise tax is correct, that there would be a tax on Walter's death, compromise tax, and then 50% on Mary's death. But that's not the case that we have here.
Let me understand that. So in a more typical trust, tax is assessed on Walter's death. There's obviously concern for the future of the remaining spouse. So a compromise tax is agreed to assess how much tax is going to be assessed on the property at that and have it paid then? Is that
what? That's correct, Your Honor.
So there isn't a chance that the state will end up with nothing, and there's also not a chance that the estate will be completely wiped out by the tax.
That's correct.
So why can't that work with the kind of trust that was done in this case?
Because the intent of the trust in this case was that 100% of the proceeds be available for Mary. We don't have two separate trusts. We don't have that they filed, they transferred the property to tenants in common. They didn't have any intention that Mary would have anything less than 100% use, function, value of the property. And I think Mr. Curry was honest when he said it was for Medicaid planning. It was because Mary had dementia and she would need care. And Walter wanted to make sure that his wife was taken care of. I think if Walter were here today and you asked Walter if it would be okay if Mary only had 50% of the property, he would say no. But in that same vein, the niece did not get 50% of the property when Walter died. If they're separate trusts and each has a life estate and one trust is extinguished and goes to the residual beneficiary, sure, there's a tax because that's the transfer.
Was that why the division did not tax the trust at Walter's death?
That's correct, because nothing transferred to the niece when Walter died based upon the facts of this case.
Whereas if there was a Walter Van Riper trust solo, then that trust would have taken that half of the property at the time of his death, and that's when you would have taxed it?
Correct.
But in theory, if I understand what you're saying, since there's that string until Mary dies, if when Mary died and the tax would be payable, the value of that asset was zero. For example, it cost $1 million to take care of Mary, the property's worth $1 million, net estate is zero, the tax is zero.
Correct, because the property is valued as of date of death. So if at her date of death the value is zero, it would be a tax on zero, so yes.
But I always thought, okay, never mind. Never mind.
I want to hear what you always thought.
No,
How would this have worked if Walter and Mary had separate trusts, but they intended to accomplish the same result, and with the niece as a contingent beneficiary. Can you play that out for us?
I don't really know if there's a possible way to have worked it out as tenants in common so that Mary would have 100% of the home and be able to use 100% of the proceeds, which is why this is a little bit different from other cases. Here, what we have is, even if they were separate trusts, then Mary would only have 50% of the value of the property, and that's clearly not what was intended by the trust documents. And again, the question is, when is that string that the decedent holds on to, when is that finally cut? In this case, yes. It's not cut until Mary died.
When you say the decedent holds on to it, it's really the trust. I mean, the trust is in the driver's seat, not Mary. I mean, trustee is looking over the estate on behalf of Mary. You keep on saying this. Mary doesn't have the string. The trust has the string, correct?
Mary, putting aside that she had dementia, Mary was integral in agreeing to the trust language and then agreed to transfer the property into the trust. So based upon the trust language, she held the string.
She retained the life estate.
Correct. She retained not just a life estate. It was actually a little more than a life estate, because the trust document specifically stated that the trustee couldn't even sell the house without using 100% of the proceeds to care for Mary. So it was actually a little bit even more than a life estate.
The string is Mary's interest in the property in reality during her life.
That's absolutely correct. And Mary, in fact, lived in 100% of the property during her life. She didn't live in half a house with half a kitchen or one bathroom. She lived in the entire house. And the niece did not obtain any ownership interest until Mary passed away. She got nothing. The niece got nothing when Walter passed away.
Why, though? I know you're saying that Mary retained an ownership interest that you're describing as this life interest to care for her. I'm having trouble considering it the kind of property that you're calling it, because it seems to me she only has that status because she's a beneficiary of the trust, not because of any deed language.
That's correct, but that's the function of the inheritance tax is a little bit of a legal fiction. So we look at not necessarily deed language, but actual reality of the ownership interest. So if somebody transfers a property to
But the argument, Ms. Anderson, that's being made to us is that we have case law NAP that says when you transfer property held by tenancy to the entirety to another person or entity, that severs the tenancy and that should be applied here when the transfer is to a trust. And then the argument that's being made to us is that the trust document defines the nature of that holding that you're describing as property ownership string, and they're seeing it as something different. So can you address that for me?
They're seeing it as something different only in terms of, I guess, presumably that Mary only had 50% of a string, but she didn't have 50% of a string. The trust did, in fact, define the parameters of Mary's ownership or interest.
I think the 50% is a bit of a shorthand, speaking for myself, because I'm not hearing from your adversaries that they dispute that tax was owed or could have been and should have been paid at the time of Walter's death. So to the extent there was a tax liability, there was a roughly 50%, however you go through the compromise tax formula, that was due and owable to the state at the time Walter died, and that not more than the equivalent of that rough 50% could have been owed to the state later on when Mary died and other actions with respect to this race or proceeds of this race had to be acted upon based upon the terms of the trust. So I feel like we're sliding back and forth into tenancy language when we're really dealing with terminology of a trust and the rights of a beneficiary, which have to now be translated in terms of what is and is not a transfer under the inheritance tax statute, because we're bound by the language of the statute, aren't we?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, the language of the statute says that it should be includable in the estate and taxed under the transfer inheritance tax if the decedent has an interest or retains an interest. Now, when Mary transferred the property into the trust, she retained a life estate, a full life estate in 100% of the property of the trust.
So you're saying Walter's death was not a taxable event for your purposes?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you talked about intent, and you said that if Walter were here today, he would say that he intended that she have 100% use of the house for all of those years, and that this trust, and the way it turned out in terms of taxes, is consistent with his intent. And yet you also told us this is a rare, unusual formulation for a trust, and that the usual way of doing this is in separate trusts that are taxable, the first one being taxable on the death of the transfer being taxable on the death of the first spouse.
That's correct.
Why isn't this, if it's consistent with one spouse having an interest in the care and well-being of the second spouse, why isn't this the predominant way to conduct estate planning?
I don't know. I don't know why it's not the predominant way, but it is not from what the Division of Taxation sees from the returns that are filed before it on a regular basis.
You said that under the trust instrument, Walter's death was not a taxable event?
Correct.
Did Walter's estate have to file, let's say that's the only property that Walter owned. Well, I guess the trust owns at that point. Would Walter's estate even have to file
an
inheritance? Okay.
No, Your Honor. That actually wasn't the only property that Walter owned, as it turned out.
But if it was,
nothing
would have to be filed by his
correct.
Estate.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Tell us your position, please, on the federal example that we've talked about.
The federal example?
The IRS.
The federal law doesn't have inheritance tax. So trying to apply gift tax law to New Jersey law is doesn't really make a lot of sense. So New Jersey is one of the few states in this country that does, in fact, have an inheritance tax. And at the time of Mary's death, we had an estate tax as well. We were one of only, I believe, two that had both. And so trying to apply federal law, it doesn't really mesh, because federal law doesn't have an inheritance tax. So
So, and the gift tax is a different concept because the grantor pays the tax on the gift?
That's absolutely correct,
There's
Your Honor.
No liability whatsoever on the person who's the donee of the gift.
Correct, Your Honor.
So we should ignore the feds on this one.
Exactly. Ignore the feds. And, in fact, the inheritance tax is joint and several liability. It's not just on the estate. It's, by law, it's joint and several liability. It's a tax on the beneficiary and the executor of the estate. The Division of Taxation can choose to go after both or either. So in some of Your Honor's examples, in fact, the niece would have been liable for 50% of the tax under the plaintiff's argument at the time Walter died, and we could have, in fact, went after her personally.
You understand from their standpoint, the Land Title Association has no way of valuing the estate tax implications of this trust. They have no, essentially, they stood up here and said, based on this interest that Mary retains, and the life estate of Walter, life estate of Mary, if it's not a taxable event to Walter when he dies, but it is when Mary dies, we have no way of valuing what in the world that's going to be from our standpoint. And that's, I guess, the uncertainty that everyone is concerned about. It's a lot easier to calculate and fix if you fix it on the date of either spouse.
I don't know if I agree. I think it's much easier to calculate and value something as of Mary's date of death, because the second spouse to die, it's very simple. What is the value of the property?
Well, no, it's not. She's got a life estate, and it's going to consume the value or a portion of the value of the property for as long as she may live and take down that amount. So it could be, I guess you could value it at the top, 50%. 100% of the value of the property, or try to figure out what she's likely to cost.
But when she's dead, there isn't any more consumption.
Oh, I know.
I'm saying at the date of her death.
I'm not disagreeing with that. Yeah. I'm talking about they're predicting the value of her interest when, I guess, Walter passes.
You're saying it.
Everything is valued on the date of the second spouse.
Correct.
Under this kind of trust.
Correct. And you don't have to value anything when the first spouse passes away. You don't have to think about what Mary may or may not consume, whether she has dementia, doesn't have dementia. The simplest answer is to wait until the second spouse dies, and then you know exactly what the beneficiary is getting. That way we don't have a situation where the niece is going to have to pay an inheritance tax for something she never actually receives.
So from your standpoint, counsel didn't make any mistake in the way he handled the estate at the time of Walter's death. Either way, it was going to be what happens at the time of Mary's death that determines the tax.
I think the language in the return was incorrect, but end result was correct.
Okay.
Yes. There was no tax due when Walter passed away, 100% of taxable when Mary passes away, and that ensures that everybody knows exactly what they're getting when the beneficiary receives their inheritance, and we aren't taxing beneficiaries on things they may never receive, and we're not taxing beneficiaries who may not have the money. In this particular instance, the niece was able to take the property and do whatever she wanted with the property, sell it, mortgage it, to get the money to pay the inheritance tax.
Other questions, anyone? Hmm. Anything you'd like to add?
No, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Curry, brief rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd just like to correct the record. The return, Schedule C, was complete. In fact, it represented that, reported on Walter's death, equity and residence at 515 Crescent Parkway. This is Exhibit PA-21. Transferred to Walter and Riper Trust, under the will of December 5th, 2007, trust provides for life estate to surviving spouse, appraisal attached, trust agreement attached. So we gave him the trust, and I reported half of it, $525,000. That was not picked up by the Inheritance Tax Bureau. They did not tax it. I submit to the court that they should apply 5434-1, and it's a transfer of deed within 3 years of death prior to the death of grantor is subject to New Jersey inheritance taxes. That's the second part, the last part of 5434-1. So I'm surprised by the Bureau's position that there would be no tax upon Walter's death. Co-counsel was kind enough, amicus was kind enough to forward me a copy of 5436-6, which answers the questions given to me earlier. The trustee could execute a bond to the state of New Jersey after computing the compromise tax. Mary did not have a stream. Mary had no fee interest in the property. All that ended upon the transfer to the real estate trust, which was irrevocable. If it were not irrevocable, we wouldn't be here. Applying the law as it is now, 50%, which is what Walter transferred and I reported, was taxable at that time, and a bond could have been filed by the trustee. When he dies on December the 4th, that is the taxable event for half of this transfer made to the trust. The other 50% is not taxable until December 23rd, 2013. The argument about, well, it could have been consumed and Mary would have had 100% of it, take care of her. Well, that didn't happen. The court has to look at what actually happened. We're not dealing with a contingency here. So I asked the court to apply New Jersey law as it is now and not basically ignore the transfer to the trust of the entire, all the bundle of rights that we looked to when we learned back in Evidence 101 of the fee simple interest in the property. And I submit if the Inheritance Tax Bureau had applied the law back then, we wouldn't be here and only 50% should be taxed.
I do have one question. I thought the statute you cited excluded from that provision the case that we have here where it's a surviving spouse
in what
retains
respect
an interest. It specifically said excluding the right of a spouse's surviving joint tenant.
Well, she's not a joint tenant. That's the problem. Everybody thinks that she's a joint tenant. She's not. The trust owns the property. She doesn't own it. Walter doesn't
own it. I understand.
That's the problem. And that's the whole problem here. We keep on going back and forth, and that's the problem. All I ask is the court to impose the current law, and there is an out with regard to the bond. Otherwise, it's going to cause a terrible problem. It's going to ignore New Jersey trust law. We can't do that.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel and for the helpful arguments from Amiki as well. We'll take the matter under advisement. We're going to take a brief recess and come out for State versus Olenowski.